Imagine yourself sitting on a hillside in first century Judea. You and a crowd of other Jews are listening to Jesus. He and a lawyer in the crowd are talking about the ancient commandment to love thy neighbor. The lawyer wants to pin Jesus down, so he asks, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus answers with a story about a guy robbed and left for dead on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. He's been stripped of his clothing, so there's no way to tell what tribe he belongs to. Two high officials of the Jewish religious establishment come by. Both see the victim lying there. Both pass on the other side of the road. Then comes a traveler from nearby Samaria. He too sees the victim lying there. And then Jesus delivers a shocker, declaring that the Samaritan had compassion for the victim. Your mind is rebelling at this turn in the story. You and all other Jews despise the Samaritans as worse than heretics, as turncoats who sided repeatedly with the oppressors of Israel. You have never heard the word good connected with the word Samaritan. The story continues. By taking charge of the bleeding victim, the Samaritan makes himself a risky, slow-moving target. He expends his scarce wine and oil tending the victim's wounds. He takes him to Jericho, prepays for lodging, and promises to return and pay all additional expenses. As you listen to this story, you're looking for a character you can identify with. Obviously, it can't be the robbers. The church officials are out. They walked on by. You'd like to identify with the generous rescuer, but he's a Samaritan. You definitely don't want to see yourself as the victim, but it seems to come down to either him or the Samaritan. You feel very conflicted. Jesus has given you a startling answer to the question, "Who is my neighbor?" He challenges you to be compassionate to an enemy. But that's not the half of it. The storyteller is suggesting that you may be the one in the ditch. And you know Jesus isn't just talking about physical jeopardy. His point is that you are in great spiritual jeopardy. Help is on the way, he's saying. And it's coming in the form of someone you despise. Imagine that. Oh, sweet irony. The Good Samaritan parable is an echo in story form of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. In that sermon, he declared, "You have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." The Jewish people were repeatedly victimized by enemy occupations. Imagine how it hit their ears to be told to be generous to these imperialists. Or worse yet, that their enemies would rescue them from spiritual jeopardy. Why did Jesus say such a thing? His purpose was to challenge his people's conventional notion of generosity. This challenge is as radical today as it was then. Our modern definition of generosity is simply liberality in giving. The synonyms for this word include magnanimity and largesse. So our notion of generosity is closely tied to abundance. But if generosity requires abundance, then when someone is generous, he's only giving away his surplus, things that don't really matter very much. And so the people to whom he's giving don't matter very much either. And how undemocratic is this conventional notion of generosity. It only allows those who are well off to be generous. Occasionally, we see someone act outside this abundance-oriented notion of generosity. Recently, a friend of mine was on her way to soccer practice, running late. She came to a green light just in time to make a left turn before an oncoming car reached the intersection. She never saw the two women in the crosswalk until they slammed onto the hood of her car. She jumped out and ran to them and then called an ambulance. Someone else stopped and was helping the injured pedestrians. My friend sat there on the curb, numbed by what had happened, not knowing what to do except wait for the ambulance. Then she looked over at the two injured women and saw one of them looking back at her with the kindest and most forgiving smile. Think back to how you felt toward another driver who even just ran into your car. There she lay with what turned out to be a broken pelvis, one of the most painful injuries a person can suffer, and managed to smile. As if to say, I know you didn't mean it. I know you are a good person and you just made a mistake. I forgive you. The accident victim was not well off, quite the contrary. All she had to give was a look of forgiveness for a negligent stranger. But that look meant everything to my friend. That smile was radical generosity. In addition to being linked to abundance, our usual way of thinking about generosity is also tied up with altruism. The generous actor is seen as having nobly sacrificed his own self-interest for the sake of another. Altruistic generosity is seen thus as being above and beyond the call of any duty. And in this way of thinking, it's natural for the giver to feel entitled to judge who is and is not a worthy recipient. Occasionally, we see someone reach out to another in a way that goes far beyond this altruistic, discretionary notion of generosity. In an urban church, strangers often ring the doorbell and ask to speak with a minister. One day, when I was the intern minister at the Portland, Oregon UU Church, two people came into the church office, identifying themselves as husband and wife. Her voice cracking with distress, the wife said that they had been sleeping on the streets for over a week. She had a huge backpack on an aluminum frame with a bedroll and other belongings tied to it. Their clothes were ragged and dirty. The husband looked sick and hardly spoke. The wife explained how they got to Portland and what had happened to them. She asked for $130 for bus tickets back to Texas, where they hoped to get help. I tried to tell her that the church did not have money to distribute in situations like this. But the wife pleaded with me to see if something could be done. I agreed to check with others in the office, and I asked the two strangers to wait there. Another visitor, also from outside the church, had been sitting nearby in the reception area during this conversation. I found out later she was an accountant, waiting to have a meeting about church financial reports. She followed me down the hall. Her pocketbook opened and her checkbook came out. She said she wanted to help. While the church bookkeeper cashed her $130 check, I asked her to explain to me what this meant to her. She shrugged her shoulders and said, "This is what God put me here to do." We had a short but fascinating conversation about that remark. I asked her about her church and she identified a fundamentalist Christian one. We walked back out with the cash. The relieved, elated couple hugged us and then headed down the street to the bus station with their huge backpack. This giver's generosity was not altruistic. There was no sense of sacrifice in it, no inflated self-nobility. She was matter-of-fact about it. She talked about it the way a person might talk about exercising regularly or eating healthy food. Something that had to do with her own well-being as much as that of the people she was reaching out to. And there was no judgment about the worthiness of these two strangers beyond their obviously precarious situation. The giver couldn't even be sure their need was genuine. But clearly, in her mind, the possibility of extending a helping hand to strangers in need easily outweighed any worry about the possibility of being conned. Returning to my office, I pondered her generosity. And I wondered about my own attitude toward her and her people, fundamentalist Christians. My mind ran over the huge gulf between the perspectives of my people and her people on so many of the big moral issues of the day. I knew I would find her church strange if I went there. From the perspective of my values, some of her church's values looked very strange indeed. I asked myself whether I could be as generous to her as she was to these two strangers. I was a mere trainee then, of course. Now that I've graduated from seminary, I'm fully evolved and never have any deficit of generosity or any problems with these issues. There was nothing saintly about the generous actors in these stories. The Samaritan traveler, the auto accident victim, the accountant in the church office. They were regular folks. What moved them to do what they did? They were able to step beyond conventional generosity, which is based on differences between people, based on being a person of abundance who has leftovers and is sharing them with people who don't have enough. Instead, their generosity was based on the sameness of people, on kinship. Now, it's easy to see this kinship in the familiar people around us. And it's no small thing to be kind even to our own kind. But sometimes, with those we already recognize as our own kind, this can turn out basically to be one hand washing the other. All those mutual support networks that we have with the people we're close with. When we reach out to a stranger or an enemy, though, the meaning of our actions is pretty unmistakable, an expression of the love in our hearts. In recognizing someone as our kind or kin, we see ourselves in that other person. We see that person for the truth she really is, for her basic humanity. This is the foundation for love of another person. Love expressed in action is the real meaning of generosity. And to express love in action toward a stranger or an enemy, to treat that person as kin, I say, is radical generosity. Love behind enemy lines. I think the generosity of these actors in this morning's stories flows from this cause. They saw themselves in the strangers they encountered. These unusual encounters brought something transformative in the church office, out there on the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, at an intersection in the middle of a traffic accident. Even if only for a brief time, something transformative happened, something shifted, an experience of wholeness and completion. This explains the perplexing claim conveyed by the parable of the Good Samaritan, that the stranger or enemy is our spiritual rescuer. Somewhere deep in our hearts, I believe we know that all people are one kind, even as we honor our transient differences. Affirming this truth by our actions is a critical step toward spiritual wholeness, which is not an individual matter, but inherently a collective one. If you go through life without expressing the radical generosity that is waiting in your heart, if you harden your heart to the stranger or the enemy, you will miss the chance for spiritual wholeness. We're living in a time of lines drawn in the sand between so many us's and them's. Hearts have hardened so much that we find our very neighbors being treated as enemies. This otherizing of people right next to us is happening now in Virginia in the form of a referendum being placed on the November ballot designed to stigmatize gay people and make them less than citizens. It's called the Marriage Amendment, as I understand it, to the Virginia Constitution. We can't expect to have spiritual wholeness in a society that tries to make laws about love, about who shall love whom, and how much, and by what name. In the sight of God, there is nothing strange about any two people loving each other and making a commitment to grow with and care for each other. We have to be allies with the targets of the love laws. We have to stand on the side of love. But we have to be more than the gallant rescuer in the poem by Neil Bowers that Jennifer read this morning. We have to show compassion both for those who are targets of such laws and for those who are working to enact them. We can't let our compassion for the targeted people turn into fear and hatred of those doing the targeting. Now, I've been saying we about this ballot referendum. Who do I mean when I say we? Let's be honest. Unitarian Universalists are not unanimously supportive of same-sex marriage. Can I be a religious leader of deep conviction on this very important issue and still hang on to my respect and compassion for fellow UUs who disagree? The path of radical generosity is wonderfully enlivening, but steep. We can walk that path only if we stay connected to the realization that our own spiritual wholeness depends on it. The generous actors in this morning's stories experienced a flash of that realization, enough to fuel at least a single dramatic gesture of radical generosity. To sustain this loving attitude, though, each of us needs help from other people who also cherish the value of radical generosity and who need help too. All such people need a place in which to practice this mutual support. A sanctuary of open-minded and open-hearted values in a world grown hardened and angry and fearful. My name for such a place is church. Our church declares to the world that we need not wait for experiences of spiritual wholeness to happen to us now and then, like a bolt out of the blue. Our church is based on a conviction that such experiences can be cultivated in an intentional religious community. As a vehicle for this mission, the sanctuary in which we're sitting this morning is a precious and fragile thing. it is worthy of our compelling commitment. Worthy of all we can do to nurture and sustain it, so that, in turn, it may nurture and sustain each of us in our pursuit of spiritual wholeness. When Jesus answered the question, "Who is my neighbor?" he challenged his audience to broaden the kind of people to whom they showed kindness and from whom they accepted kindness. The parable continues to deliver this challenge today. If we can't meet it, all the mass movements for peace and justice won't make any lasting difference. We can broaden what we call our kind further than we think. We can include the one who is a stranger, the one who has been labeled an enemy. Even after thousands of years of paying so dearly for our small, tribal notion of generosity, it is not too late to do this. It is not too late to answer this challenge given on a hillside in ancient Judea by a man who knew the meaning of spiritual wholeness, a man who loved deeply and was willing to act radically.